Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Surgical Care Improvement Project conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the call, please press star, then zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Ms. Denise Faulkner-Cameron. You may begin.
Thank you, Jai. And good morning again to everyone, and thank you for joining us on this, our sixth conference call for the Surgical Care Improvement Project, IPG. Today's call will be twofold. We will be discussing senior leadership reporting during the first portion and appropriate hair removal during the second. Before we begin, I would like to give those who have not yet accessed the materials for today's call to log on to Jenny, our online community forum at Jenny, that's J-E-N-Y, .ipro.org, no www. Click on the Surgical Care Improvement Project forum under Hospital Quality Improvement. And just as a reminder, the password to access the SKIP forum is Skyrocket. And once you're in the SKIP forum, then click on the link referencing to today's call materials. And the materials for the call include an agenda, a short slide set for the discussion on senior leader reporting, an example of a completed senior leadership report, the data abstraction tool, which will be reviewed by William Gardner later on in the call, and a schedule for submitting the senior leadership reports that we'll go over later. Also included are the slides for Dr. Stimler's discussion on appropriate hair removal. And lastly, there is an evaluation form that we will remind everyone to complete upon the conclusion of the call. So let's go ahead and get started. Now, we decided to focus on senior leader reporting in preparation for the remeasurement period, which, as everyone knows, is first quarter 2007, and a number of hospitals haven't submitted any senior leadership reports as yet. However, we would like to thank those teams who have been submitting their reports on an ongoing basis. And we just wanted to remind everyone of this important facet of quality improvement work. And we felt that communicating your progress was an appropriate title for this presentation, as communicating the essence of your project is the primary role of the senior leader report. One point that we'd like to remind everyone is that while we ask hospitals to share their senior leader reports with us, IPRO is not the targeted audience for these reports. It's your senior leadership, since it was your CEO who enrolled your facility in this initiative. Therefore, it is important that he or she be aware of the team's progress. And the senior leader report is the ideal for monitoring how well the team is or isn't meeting the goals set at the onset of the project. Furthermore, it defines barriers that impede your ability to reach those goals and track change strategies or other interventions that you came up to address those barriers as you strive for improvement. And finally, once you reach your improvement goals, the senior leadership report is a useful device in assuring that you maintain that level of performance or simply hold your gains. So what information should you include in the senior leader report? For the most part, the text should be dedicated to describing the barriers and improvement strategies that we referred to in the previous slide, as well as outline the team members' responsibilities. And you should also try as much to include a summary of successes and lessons learned as they relate to the barriers and improvement strategies. And just a note also is that senior leadership reports should not be too lengthy, but should have enough information so that it's clear to others what your efforts are, so they can be easily duplicated or spread. And of course, data and measurement is an important part. And lastly, each of the elements mentioned on this slide should be delineated by the performance measures included in the project. And as we mentioned, data and measurement is an important part of senior leadership reporting, and the method of that data is concurrent data review. And we are aware of the time that has to be put into this kind of review, and their concerns with regards to staff shortages and other resources that you may be lacking. But to address those concerns, we just want to remind you of a few points concerning concurrent data review. First, it should only be based on a small sample of cases, perhaps 5 to 10 a week, depending on your volume of surgeries. Second, it is not as involved as the retrospective review that you do on a quarterly basis, and therefore does not require that you spend as much time as you would abstracting cases to submit to the warehouse. And this is because when you're doing concurrent data review, you're only focusing on specific data elements that relate to the measure or measures and would therefore require that you go directly to the source within the medical records to find those data elements. So with that said, what are we looking for in each chart? And in essence, each question is just a quick yes or no. For example, did the patient receive the prophylactic antibiotic within 1 hour prior to incision? So for that answer, it would simply require you to go to the anesthesia record or wherever in the chart you record the surgery start time and antibiotic time to get the answer to determine if the case met that indicator. Also, if the patient underwent colon surgery, was the first post-op temp recorded within 1 hour between 96.8 and 100.4? And for that, you would simply go to the PACU notes or wherever that first the post-op temp is recorded to get that answer. Lastly, if a patient underwent an elective total knee replacement, did that patient receive the low molecular weight heparin or was the IPC device applied, as either of those regimens will meet the VTE2 indicator, and also was there an order for the appropriate prophylaxis documented so it can meet the VTE1 indicator under that module. Now, William Gardner, one of our project managers on the hospital team, designed a nifty tool to facilitate you in this type of data review. It's a tool that some of you have already seen, and Bill is on the line with us today to give a demonstration for those who may not have yet the opportunity to use this tool. So, Bill, could you please walk us through the tool?
Sure, Denise. Thank you. The tool that you have in front of you, it's designed as an Excel spreadsheet. And when you go into the spreadsheet itself and open it, there are tabs at the bottom of the sheet. The first tab is the instruction tab. The second tab is the tool itself. And then the third tab is really the calculation of the ACM rate over time. I think it's important to mention that this is really not a data abstraction tool. It's a data monitoring tool or an audit tool. It's really meant to do a quick review of your skip measures and any skip measure that you want to review for. It doesn't have to be a tool that's used to look at every skip measure. For example, if you only want to look at the skip infection measures, you could do a quick chart review of only the skip measures that are identified there for infection. Again, if you wanted to do the thromboembolic measures, you could do those, but it's not meant to be an all-exclusive, inclusive tool for every measure, but it can be. So the other thing I wanted to point out is that if you use this tool as an Excel tool and use it in Excel, it's important to note that many of these cells are locked. And I did that intentionally because if you've ever used Excel and you inadvertently delete a formula or put a different number in a formula line, it can really kind of mess up your entire spreadsheet here. So I intentionally locked things, and the only areas that you can really enter data in are in the chart ID field and under the review columns for met, not met, or NA, which is not applicable. And as you enter into these areas, the spreadsheet itself is a self-calculating spreadsheet. So as you go through these, if you do enter a 1 is yes, that it met the measure, a 0 is no, it did not meet the measure, and an NA is it's really not applicable. And as you see if you've dropped this to paper or if you're looking on the screen, at the far end of the spreadsheet, there's a column under the chart review for each chart itself. There's a total met, there's a total not met, total NA, and there's a cell that says total met plus not met plus NA should equal 12 because there's a total of 12 measures. That's really just a secondary check that you've filled in all of those boxes. At the very bottom of the sheet is patients are only included in the numerator for skip calculation if the score is 100%. So at the very bottom of the sheet there, you see there's a double-lined box. It says numerator, those who scored 100%, denominator, and those are all of the patients that you did a chart review on, and then the percent score will give you your score for that review itself. The Excel spreadsheet is really designed to be used in Excel, or you can drop it to paper, and it's pretty easy to calculate all of the met or not met or NAs just as tallying up the numbers themselves. But again, it was really designed to be data entered into. And what we've tried to do is really keep it simple. There's room for 10 charts here to review for, and again, not all of the measures have to be reviewed for, but whatever you're reviewing for on those 10 charts should be filled in. As you go through the tool itself, and again, I guess you can practice in it too. You'll notice that if you inadvertently try to enter information into a cell that's locked, you'll get a dialog box or a pop-up window that will tell you that the cell is locked, and it's really not designed to have data entered into. It would ask you for a password to change that cell if you wanted to change the content of it. But again, the purpose of it is that it's a locked spreadsheet, and it does self-calculate for you. The other thing that I wanted to point out about the tool itself, at the end of the sheet, where you determine your score for your chart review for this time around, where the numerator and the denominator are in that double-lined box. The third tab at the bottom of the spreadsheet is really your ongoing calculation of your ACM score. So the numerator and the denominator are meant to be lifted from the second tab, and then you can put that information into the third tab. So the third tab is really just a small table, and it says skip at the top, and it says numerator, those who met all the measures, and the denominator goes there, and then your ACM rate is calculated for you. Only those patients who pass all of the measures that you're reviewing for are in the numerator. So, again, it's an all-or-nothing approach, and that's how the ACM is calculated. At this point in time, that concludes my overview of the SKIP tool. And again, I would encourage you to really put some false data into the spreadsheet and see how it works and see how it calculates. And again, I would encourage you to use it. When Margaret Schaefer and I, we've been out to some facilities and actually done a SKIP chart review. And this is the tool that we use. I mean, we bring this along with us. We enter our data into this. We've dropped it to paper for our purposes for an on-site chart review. But, again, we're only doing 10 charts, but it gives us a very good idea and a very good overview of how you're doing with your SKIP measures. And at this point, I will turn the call back to Denise.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you for reminding us of the usefulness of the tool. I just want to make another note about the tool, and that is that it has been posted to MedKIC, which is CMS's online resource for quality improvement, and it has also been adopted by QIOs in other states who have also shared it with their hospitals. So it has really proven to be very useful, and again, we hope that you will find it useful as well. To wrap up this discussion about senior leadership reporting, I would just like to quickly refer you to the sample senior leader report that we included with the handouts for the call. And it is a senior leadership report that was actually completed by one of the hospitals participating in the IPG. And you will note the concise format, and that it includes all the elements that we discussed earlier. It is outlined by all of the measures under the respective modules. It has a place to record your data. And just as a reminder, we included first quarter 2005 as baseline, since that's the period that CMS has designated for the project. It includes an area for you to document what your barriers are and what improvement strategies you've incorporated as part of your project to address those barriers and move forward in improving. And it also has an action column for you to document your timeframes as well as the team members who are going to be responsible for that aspect of the project. So at your own leisure, I would really encourage you to look over this completed senior leadership report and use it as an example. And I also would just like to reiterate something that we said before, and that is if hospitals have their own format for reporting, they are more than welcomed and encouraged to use it. We just suggest that it contain the information that we talked about. And finally, you'll see on the last slide of the PowerPoint presentation that we are again going to ask hospitals to submit the senior leadership reports on a monthly basis by the third Tuesday of each month, starting with this month. So that would mean that the next report will be due on October 23rd. And for your convenience, we included with this call a schedule outlining the due dates for the senior leadership reports for over the next 6 months. And just for clarification, that the senior leader report that you submit for the month should reflect the previous month's activity. So the October 23rd report should reflect activities that took place in that occurred in September. Now that concludes the discussion on senior leadership reports. And at this time, we will go right into the second portion of the call, which is focusing on appropriate hair removal. And leading this discussion is our medical director, Dr. Charles Stimler.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Denise, and thank you, Bill. I'm going to be following along with the slideshow that had been posted to Jenny under skip_hair2, I believe it was. And the discussion on hair removal is something that we often gloss over. I think of all the performance measures, hair removal is probably the one that's the most obscure in some ways, in terms of discussions. It doesn't seem as glamorous, perhaps, as some of the other ones, but it's surprising how much evidence there is to support it, and it's also quite striking how much of a benefit it provides to patients, and we're going to explore that in just a moment. I'm going along with the slides now, and I'm just going to first review the performance measure itself. It's defined as the percentage of surgery patients with appropriate surgical site hair removal. And as per the measure, appropriate methods include no hair removal at all. Now, I just want to emphasize that doing absolutely nothing regarding hair removal is considered appropriate. Leaving the hair in place is fine. Also appropriate is the use of clippers. And also appropriate is the use of a depilatory cream or a cream that just dissolves the hair. The only inappropriate method is shaving with a razor. Well, the theoretical background, how did this all come about? Actually, for the greater part of the century, it has just been assumed that shaving with a razor is the right way to go. It's always been assumed that it's always been known that hair is dirty. Hair clearly is a reservoir of bacteria. And I suppose it makes some intuitive sense that one would want to get rid of the hair, one would want to remove the hair from the operative field to reduce the burden of bacteria. However, we know scientifically, though, that shaving is not a panacea. Shaving causes nicks. It damages the skin. It leads to microabrasions, which permit entry to bacteria that can seed the wound, or the area where there have been the microabrasions, and actually may feed off the subcutaneous tissues as a culture media, and may actually, and this all may actually encourage bacterial growth right in an area where you don't want to have that happening. So the hypothesis of many of the studies we're going to be looking at that support avoiding shaving all hypothesize that avoiding shaving and using some alternative method or no method at all, leaving the hair in place, should reduce infection rates by preventing bacterial entry through the epidermis layer of skin. And I guess some of the early inklings that there might be something wrong with shaving popped up during the 1970s and the 1980s with a series of studies and some epidemiological observations such as the one on this slide. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology in 1987 and described an outbreak of a nosocomial infection with serratia marcescens that occurred in a cardiac surgery unit with 10 patients becoming infected, 5 seriously so with osteomyelitis, and 3 who developed bacteremia with serratia. And ultimately, the epidemiological investigation narrowed down to the who they call the barbers, so the people who were doing the shaving prep prior to surgery. And they found that all of these infected patients shared the same team that did the shaving. And the investigators ultimately cultured bacteria from both the some of the trays and implements of the shavers, as well as the hands and garments of the actual personnel involved. So it became clear that shaving could be a cause of nosocomial infection. Next slide just goes over again options for hair removal, because now I'm going to go into some of the studies that compare some of these other options to shaving. We have razor shave. We all are familiar with that. There's also electrical clippers, which could be used either the night before or the morning of surgery. There's depilatory creams, and there's doing nothing at all. And gleaned from the literature, these are some aspects of alternatives that are probably very desirable if you're going to use an alternative. In other words, if you're going to decide to remove the hair in some manner, if you're going to use an electrical clipper, you're going to want to have the capability for washing and oiling the head between uses to cut down on spread between patients. Also, you want the clipper to be able to leave about 1 to 2 millimeters of stubble, not much more. I mean, you could leave more, but you don't want it to be much less than that. The technique for performing clipping with electrical clippers actually takes some practice. And for people who are just starting out with it, a lot of times the nurses or technicians will want to do a clean shave even though they're using electrical clippers. They'll have a tendency to push down very hard on the clippers. And it turns out that you could mimic the effect of a razor by taking a clipper and pushing down really hard on it. You can get a shave that's pretty much at the skin level. And if you do that, you're actually causing the same microabrasions that you cause by using razors. So the learning curve involves knowing just about exactly how much of a stubble you need to leave and not to try to go for a clean shave with electrical clippers. In fact, some of the studies that have compared clipping to shaving have shown that in the early part of the study, the infection rates are pretty similar. And that's because the people doing the clipping originally think that they ought to be doing a clean shave, and they push down too hard on the clippers, and they ultimately cause the same skin damage that you get with using razors. So if you're going to use clippers, you know, you've got to be sure you know the technique well. Regarding depilatory cream, there are a series. These are the characteristics that you want to have in the depilatory cream. It ought to be bacteriostatic or bactericidal. It should lack local toxicity, obviously, and be hypoallergenic, if at all possible. It needs to be effective, clearly, and it should be non-irritating. And basically, as you decide on which depilatory to use and you go through the various manufacturers, this is sort of a checklist that you can use to determine whether it's a satisfactory depilatory or not. Well, now I'm going to review in depth 3 studies that compare shaving with alternative methods. And you'll see that these are a little bit older studies, but very well done. And these are going to be presented in somewhat chronological order. The first one is from the American Journal of Surgery in 1971 by Seropian. And they looked at depilatory cream versus shaving. They did a randomized prospective trial of 406 mixed pediatric and adult cases. And also, these were mixed surgery types. This is kind of whatever surgery came their way, they included in the study. So this is a large variety of surgical types of cases. Of the 406, 155, mostly the pediatric cases, received no hair removal at all. So therefore, they were not randomized to depilatory versus shaving. It was within the surgeon's discretion whether or not the patient was going to be entered into the study or not. So 155 patients just, you know, didn't get any hair removal. And another factor within the discretion of the surgeon was the time for the razor prep. So some surgeons did it earlier, some surgeons did it immediately before the OR. That was not randomized. Some of the outcomes that were looked at in the study were, of course, wound infection was one, the clinical evaluation of the wound, and also the skin condition as evaluated by the MD and the nurse, whether it appeared that the skin was in good shape or not such good shape right prior to the incision. The pie chart on the next graph just shows you that this was really a distribution of many different types of surgical cases, clean, clean contaminated, and contaminated and dirty. The results of this study were quite striking. Wound infection rate was highest among the patients who received razor shaving at 5.6%. Those who received the depilatory cream had a substantially lower infection rate of 0.6%. This was statistically significant, but also very clinically significant because we're talking here about a 9, almost 10-fold difference in infection rate. So this is quite a remarkable finding. And for the 155 patients who were not randomized at all, who did not have any hair removal, the infection rate there was 0.6%, very similar to the ones receiving depilatory. So it seemed that, you know, the cream, no hair removal, both were fairly equivalent with razor shaving being a lot worse. And it appeared that the time interval between the razor shave and incision was also very critical. Now, this was not randomized. Again, this was as per surgeon discretion. But you can see that if the shaving was done immediately prior to OR, you had an elevated infection rate, but it was only at about 3.1%. Up to 24 hours prior to OR, the infection rate goes up to 7.1%. Earlier than 24 hours prior to going to the OR, it was a whopping 20%. One out of every five patients ultimately developed an infection. And that's all very consistent with the theory that these that shaving is causing microabrasions, the bacteria are feeding on the subcutaneous tissues. The longer time that elapses before you do surgery, the more opportunity this bacteria has to grow. Further results from this study demonstrated that the skin condition appeared to be normal in virtually all of the skin depilatory cases, but only in about 84% of the razor cases. And of those very few 1.3% of depilatory cases that it had abnormal skin, it appeared to only be some erythema, like there was a minor irritation from the cream itself. But from the 15% of razor cases that were abnormal, there were visible nicks and scratches. So they were clearly macro abrasions. They were gross violations of the epidermal barrier integrity. Interestingly, though, there was no correlation between visible evidence of abrasions and subsequent infection rates, so that those patients who had visible nicks and scratches were every bit as likely to get infected with a razor as those without the visible nicks and scratches, suggesting that you can't really judge from looking at the prep whether or not it was good enough, but that it's the microabrasions that are caused by the razors that are not visible to the naked eye that are the more important determinants of infection due to razors. Another important depilatory versus shaving study was done a little bit after Seropians. This was by Powis, published in the British Medical Journal in 76. It was another prospective randomized study in two hospitals of a much smaller number of patients, 92 patients. Again, lots of different types of surgery were included in this. The patients were split evenly into shaved and depilatory. Again, the timing of the prep was variable as per surgeon discretion. Some did it earlier than 20 hours, and some did it within 20 hours prior to going to the OR. But the thing about this study that is interesting is that they also did bacterial cultures. So they when the patient was about to go under the knife, they swabbed the skin, and they ran a culture on it to see what kind of bacterial growth there was. And they also evaluated for wound infection. Well, this particular study did not find a significant difference in infection rates. Although the rates were higher in the shaved group, it did not reach statistical significance. But the reason I'm discussing the study is that they did find some very interesting results regarding the bacterial cultures. They found that there were significantly greater numbers of pathogenic bacteria among the patients who had the early razor prep versus those who had the early depilatory prep. So it was a 95% infection rate in the razor patients and a 73% infection rate in the depilatory patients, and that was statistically significant. They also found higher colony counts on the shaved group, and that's in the next slide. You can see the colony counts. Bacteria are in the leftmost column. Staphylococci coagulase positive are obviously very common causes of wound infections, and you can see a doubling of the colony count in group one, which was the shaved group, versus group two, which was the depilatory group, a doubling of the colony count for that group, which was statistically significant. But I think as you go down the list, you can see that colony counts were enormously increased in E. coli as well as Klebsiella as well. They did not reach statistical significance, but I think it's quite striking that pretty much across the board, there were many more bacterial colonies on the razor patients. Now, and then this was all razor patients combined, not just the early preps. Now, why was this the case? Well, again, it's consistent with the hypothesis that when you shave, you create microabrasions and allow the bacteria to feed on subcutaneous tissues, so you are basically growing bacteria in situ. The final study on general surgery patients I'm going to talk about looked at clippers versus shaving, and this was done in 1983 by Alexander. And similar to the others, it was a prospective randomized study. In this case, though, they did a 2x2 factorial design. They wanted to systematically study the effect of timing as well as the method of shaving. So rather than leaving it to surgeon discretion, they actually assigned the timing to either be the night before operation or the morning of operation, and they looked at the methods being shaving versus clipping with electrical clippers. And the outcomes that they examined were purulence of the wound at discharge, which is purulence being obviously a sign of infection, purulence of the wound 30 days past discharge. This is at a follow-up visit after the patient comes back to the clinic, because not all infections are obvious at the time of discharge. Some of them, you know, appear somewhat later. They also looked at some administrative and financial outcomes, such as length of stay and total hospital costs. This next slide gives you their primary results for overall infection rates. And what is most obvious and striking here is that clipper hair removal done the morning of the surgery was by far the lowest infection rate, and was statistically significantly different from all the other methods. What's a little surprising here is that using clippers the night before surgery wasn't all that good. You can see that the rate for PM clippers actually approximates that for razors. So, you know, again, clipping is not entirely benign, probably does cause some microabrasions, but just not as many as razors do. So, it's okay if you use it right before surgery, but if you're going to wait a while, it turns out not to be such a good idea. But you can see for razors, both AM and PM razors had very high rates of overall infections. And, of course, the 30-day follow-up rate is always higher than the discharge rate because it includes the additional patients that were discovered later on. But you can see by looking at AM clippers that when compared with the total infection rate, even at the 30-day follow-up, AM clippers were at 3.2% versus a total rate of 7.6%. This is not only statistically, but a clinically significant decrease in infection rate. And it wasn't only the rate of infection, but it was the type of wound infections. AM clippers were, 3 out of 4 of the infections were superficial, which are relatively minor, easily treated, whereas you can see that many of the other methods led to a much higher number of deep infections, which are much more serious, may take a lot longer to heal and to treat. And I draw your attention also to stitch infections, because one of the common perceptions is that we need to do hair removal because the hair might get sewn into a stitch, and that might cause a stitch infection. But if you notice, the clippers led to almost no stitch infections, whereas the razors, which presumably removed all the hair that was visible, led to a significant number of stitch infections. I think this proves two things. One is that probably the clipper took out enough hair so that whatever stubble was left couldn't get sewn in. But even more importantly, I think maybe this whole notion is wrong. Maybe actually, yes, hair might not contribute, but clearly there are other factors that contribute to stitch infections besides hair that may be more significant. So that that argument really doesn't hold water. One other interesting result from this study was that nurse and physician satisfaction regarding the skin prep differed significantly. Nurses felt that patients who were prepped with the AM clippers had the best prep, and they thought that the AM shaving was the worst prep, whereas surgeons, I guess they liked perhaps the smooth skin, they felt that the AM shaving was the best prep, but that the clippers were the worst prep. But clearly that intuition was wrong, at least in the population sense, because it turned out the evidence shows us that shaving is worst and AM clippers are the best. So we need this is an example of perhaps a barrier that needs to be overcome, the perception that a clean, apparent smooth skin surface, at least what appears to be smooth to the naked eye, is better, when in reality, we're just missing all those microabrasions that are actually going to cause us trouble down the line. I was intrigued that there was an additional length of stay. It's not surprising that there was, but it's intriguing that it was so significant. 656 days per 1,000 patients were estimated for additional length of stay. And in $1,981, the additional cost estimated per 1,000 patients was about $275,000 in excess medical costs for treatment with razors. Here I've done it, I've shown you that there's a cost savings. I've made it negative $274,000 with clippers. You save money by using clippers. When translated nationally, when these data are extrapolated from the study nationally, in $1,981, there's a $3 billion cost to the use of shaving, to the use of razors. And I think we could safely multiply that by two or three to get current savings. So I think we're approaching $10 billion in terms of savings that we could achieve through the avoidance of the use of razors. And I have a couple of slides here from Cochrane Consensus. You know, they're a group that does meta-analyses. I've shown you some of the more significant individual studies. There have been a few other studies that have looked at the questions of shaving that have been inconclusive. But there is no study out there that suggests that shaving is any better. So when Cochrane looked at their meta-analysis, they compared shaving with clipping. They looked at those few studies that met their stringent criteria, one of which was the Alexander study that I presented to you, and they came to the conclusion that there's clear evidence that clipping is superior to razor shaving. You can see the diamond on the bottom does not cross the vertical 1.0 confidence interval, so it is at a 95% degree confidence that clipping is better than shaving. The next slide compares shaving versus the use of a depilatory cream. They looked at five studies that met their stringent criteria, finding that there was a strong bias in favor of the use of cream. It did not quite reach statistical significance. You could see that it just touches the confidence interval, just crosses 1.0, but almost is statistically significant and demonstrates about a 60% reduction in infection rate by using cream versus razors. Finally, I didn't discuss any studies looking at no hair removal at all, but they found one study in the Cochrane Consensus that they felt met their criteria, and again, it was not statistically significant, but it favors doing nothing or having no hair removal, again, suggesting a 60% decrease in infection rates. And before I wrap up the talk completely, I wanted to just mention that all these studies have focused on mixed surgeries, on, you know, lots of different types of surgeries mixed together. But we do have a little bit of evidence to talk to two specific areas, cardiothoracic and neurosurgery. and very briefly present the evidence that exists in these areas. There is one study that I could locate on hair removal and cardiothoracic surgery that compared the use of clippers versus shaving from the Annals of Thoracic Surgery in 92. And it was a very well done randomized prospective study of almost 2,000 consecutive adults undergoing cardiopulmonary bypass with sternotomy in the late 80s. These are mostly CABGs, but also some valvular cases or valvular and CABGs and bypass mixed, both elective and emergent. In this study, it was unusual in that surgeons were blinded to the shaving method. That hadn't been done in any of the other studies I came across. Hair removal was generally done the night before for elective surgery and on the OR table for emergency cases, and they looked specifically at the outcome of suppurative mediastinitis, which is a deep, serious, life-threatening infection. So they kind of ignored the superficial wound infections here, and they went right to the heart, pardon the pun, of what is, I think, of great concern to cardiothoracic surgeons, which are some of the very critically severe infections that they occasionally encounter. The results of the study demonstrated an overall rate for the suppurative mediastinitis of 0.86%, which was 1.3% in the razor-shaped group, but was only 0.4% in the electrical clipper group, for an odds ratio of 3.25, which was significant statistically and clearly also clinically. Even though 1.3% may seem to be a low rate, for this type of an infection, which is life-threatening, the difference between 1.3 and 0.4 is a huge difference. And the conclusion here was that clippers are superior to shaving in the prevention of suppurative mediastinitis in cardiothoracic surgery. And finally, there have been a number of studies done in neurosurgery. And I don't quite know exactly why neurosurgery became such a focus as opposed to, let's say, urological surgery or other types, but it had been noticed fairly early that not doing any hair removal at all appeared to be every bit as good as doing shaving. And I've just kind of listed down six authors that I came across. Five out of six compared razor shaving with doing no hair removal at all. One looked at minimal hair removal, and in all cases, either the alternative of doing none or minimal was better than shaving, or if it was about the same or slightly worse, it was not statistically significantly different. So at worst, there's no difference between the two methods, and at best, it appears that doing no hair removal is probably superior to doing shaving. There's yet to be a meta-analysis of this data. Hopefully, when there is, we'll have a little bit more clarity. As we've gone around to hospitals to discuss this issue, our best advice to the clinical teams has been to educate the surgical staff regarding the risks of shaving with razors. The most successful practice has been removing razors entirely from the OR, simply just taking them out physically so that they're not there. In cases where this can't be done or where there have been sort of outcries that, well, I need my shaver and this is not fair, I want to have the option of using it in occasional cases, we recommend really building some barriers to the use of razors at the very least, either limiting the availability for location or requiring some rationale for why it needs to be used in individual cases. I really want to highly recommend that ideally a razor should be avoided in all surgical cases, virtually all surgical cases. There are very few rationales for using it. We had heard of, you know, issues in GU surgery, such as scrotal surgery, where some of the GU surgeons had felt that they needed to use razors, but I can tell you that from the listservs and from the discussions we've had on amongst the QIOs that there are many institutions where GU surgeons are using clippers very successfully in scrotal surgery. So, you know, there really should be very few exceptions to this general rule of avoiding shaving. And with that, I want to thank you all. I'm going to turn the call back to Denise at this point.
Thank you, Dr. Stimler, for that comprehensive review of the literature concerning hair removal, and I hope all of our hospital audience found it very useful. At this time, Jai, can we please open up the lines for questions and answers? And I would like to just advise the audience that we are taking questions on either topic, whether it's senior leadership reporting or the discussion that Dr. Stimler presented on hair removal. Jai, can you open up the line, please?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Once again, if you do have a question, please press 1. Our first question comes from Mary Ann Gordon from John T. Mather Memorial. Please go ahead.
Denise, I have a question. Earlier you spoke about the abstracting tool is available at a particular website. I didn't catch the site.
Oh, the point I was making was that the same monitoring tool that Bill Gardner designed and just presented to us, also adopted by CMS posted to MedKick.
Okay. I just was a little confused. All right. Thank you very much.
Yes. Okay. You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Chris Porter with Bassett Healthcare. Please go ahead.
Hi. This is actually Bob Lanthi at Bassett Healthcare, cardiac surgeon. I just wanted to offer a little bit of a word of caution about the no hair removal issue for a couple of reasons. Number one, the data, as Dr. Stimler pointed out, really is not consistent, does not consistently show that there is any statistically significant difference between no hair removal and other techniques, whereas there is with clipping versus shaving. The pediatric population that he pointed out, was predominant in the one study who looked at no hair removal. They probably don't have a lot of hair to begin with. And anecdotally, being a heart surgeon and being involved in some salvage cases in the past where we had to make an incision through a very hairy chest, seeing hair in the wound at the end of the operation, particularly in the mediastinum, as Dr. Stimler pointed out, is a very concerning event. And I would just recommend toning down the idea that no hair removal might be appropriate. The data really does not support it. A meta-analysis may be appropriate, but you have a good method in front of you with clipping versus shaving. No hair removal, I would venture to say, probably should be left alone at that point, just because, again, it's not showing any laudable effects at all on the technique. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the comment.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press the 1 key at this time. I show no further questions.
Thank you, Jai. And before we conclude the call, we just have a couple of project updates that we'd like to bring to everyone. First and foremost, as many of you are aware, the clinical data warehouse will be able to accept data on the additional quality measures included under the infection module, and that's with discharges as of July 1st, 2006 and forward, and these additional measures include the normothermia for colon surgeries, normoglycemia for cardiac procedures, and of course what we discussed today, appropriate hair removal. And then data for measures under the VTE module can be submitted to the warehouse beginning with discharges as of October 1st, 2006 and forward. And as we all know, these are the two modules that CMS has asked QIOs to focus on as part of the IPG. With regards to site visits, a number of the hospitals have had a site visit by members of the IPRO team, and we are continuing these site visits. So if you haven't had one as yet, we will be visiting you quite soon. Also, I would just like to announce that our next call is on November 8th. At 10 a.m., and for the convenience of hospitals to facilitate with your team planning, we have compiled a schedule for the calls over the next 6 months, and we have posted the schedule onto Jenny. So when you get a chance, if you could take a look at it, if you haven't been able to locate it or if you need a link, please contact me, and I will send it to you. And information on the topics for discussion will be provided on an ongoing basis. Feel free to advise us of any particular topic that you would like incorporated on a conference call. And also, please note that the time for the calls will be the same. They will all be at 10 a.m., and the call-in number will also be the same. At this time, I'd like to remind everyone to please complete the evaluation form, as it really does provide us with useful feedback for all our improvement activities. And at this time, Jai, if we can just give the audience one more opportunity to ask any questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. I show no questions.
Thank you, Jai, and thank you, everyone, for taking time out of your schedule to join us for today's call. Have a good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may all disconnect and have a wonderful day.